Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 108, recorded November 30th, 2011, of Mics and Men. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia Audio and the new Radius IP Audio Console. Feature-rich, affordable IP audio consoles from Axia. On the web at axiaaudio.com. Plus, check out some of the 2,500 Axia IP audio studios worldwide at clients.axiaaudio.com. Hey, it's time for This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad to have you along. This is the show where we talk about radio technology, how we get audio here and there, how we pick it up with microphones, hopefully well, nicely, clean, how we get audio in and out of automation systems and through audio consoles. And, you know, we add in the talent and the traffic reports and the sports guy and try to make it all into something that's content that folks want to listen to. The radio industry has been doing that for years, although some would argue that occasionally it's not stuff folks want to listen to. We'll talk about that. And we'll talk about just making, in this episode, we're going to talk about voiceover. In other words, getting the every bit of a great voice talent and getting that into electronic form so we can put it on the air, you know, record it to a hard disk system and make that sound as good as possible. Our guest is going to be George Whittam. We'll introduce him in just a moment. But first, let's check out the best dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York. It's Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. Hello, everyone. So far, so good. President Obama's in town and traffic hasn't been snarled just yet. And pedestrian traffic is still moving about on the streets. So it's a good sign this evening.
Well, you made it home. You probably get home via the subway, don't you?
Subway, walking. The problem is his fundraising events take place approximately 4 blocks from where I live, 4 blocks in every direction. It's interesting, the frozen zones that appear. And actually, they're about to lock down the avenue just across the street in about 20 minutes. So it should be lots of fun in the next hour or so.
I guess you got to make sure you have plenty of peanut butter and toilet paper at the house. It's like, 'cause you're not going to be able to get out and get some, are you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, they definitely keep you from crossing the street or walking up and down, depending on where he's going to be. And there's protesters are out tonight. They're on 7th Avenue and 51st out by the Sheraton. So it's a busy night.
You know, I won't be, speaking of protesters, I won't be satisfied until they actually start protesting this show. You know, Occupy Twert. Looking forward to that.
Oh, that'll be the 1%.
Yeah, that's right. Also with us from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, let's say hello to the Ninjaneer, Chris Tarr. Hey, Chris.
Hi there. Occupying my bedroom. You can see the frog back there. I am Chris Tarr, the Ninjaneer, and I am the Director of Engineering for Intercom's Milwaukee and Madison radio stations. Also host the online forum, broadcastengineering.info. I write for Radio Guide and, of course, put my smiling face here just about every Wednesday night.
We're sure glad that you're with us. And okay, so
Carly, is all you're doing is paying for a name.
What was that?
I don't know what that was. It wasn't me.
That looks like the fun's beginning.
Yeah, it sure does. Jeez. So we have three broadcast engineers here. We have our guest who is, I don't know, is George a broadcast engineer or a little bit more specialized sort of engineer? You know, broadcast engineers can don't tell the GM, but, you know, we do know how toilets work.
I'm not going to run through this one. There's a cop standing right there.
That sounds like
probably not, but I also wanted to get a better look at this little brunette that probably, you know, 5'9", 5'10", 90 pounds soaking wet.
Man. I have that's no CB. Idea what's going on.
That's probably someone with a 100-watt CB.
Yeah, it's so, coming. Yeah. So, yeah.
Is whose Skype is that? Is that coming through, Burke?
Oh, I'd break.
I think so. Hey, hold on. Let's put a pause on this for a second.
Not mine.
This week in CB radio.
That's awesome. Anyway.
I couldn't ask for a better introduction. Thanks, thanks, everybody. Oh, man.
We had a show on RF grounding just a couple weeks ago.
No, I actually watched it.
Okay, let's begin right before George here.
Sorry. Is that one at the Twit Network?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. There's not. It's not a live. Nothing's selected. It's just interference. So,
yeah.
Wow. Hopefully, it will.
All right.
Move away.
So, put your big edit screen up right there, and we'll introduce George. You ready? We'll give him a place to edit if they want to. In 3, 2. And also joining us is an engineer who's, I don't know if he's a broadcast engineer or not. He certainly specializes in something broadcast related. Let's say hi to George Whittam. Hey, George, how are you?
Hey, Kirk, I'm doing well. I've kind of done everything. But right now I'm specializing in voiceover home studio support, consulting, and just making sure voice actors get the cleanest possible audio in their home studios, because they pretty much all have to have one these days, and unless they happen to live right next door to a great one, you know, in a big city. But that's what I do. I've got vostudiotech.com, where I run my business out of, called Eldorado Recording Services. And I'm just out there to keep people's home studios working. I've got a client base, a growing base of over 400 clients now that I just, I'm like their virtual audio engineer, technician, mechanic, and, you know, psychologist all rolled into one.
I bet it does take some psychology to work with some of the VO talent that you do. So, George, you've already alluded to, okay, you run this company that does engineering services primarily for voiceover talent. Now, you're located out in the West Coast, right?
I am. I'm here in Santa Monica.
It seems like the West Coast has a disproportionate number of voiceover talent. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot. They tend to flock here. I mean, I know talent that have been very successful in Chicago and other markets that decide to come out here because that gives them an opportunity to have a piece of a bigger pie now. Animation. I mean, this is where animation is being recorded. You know, the voiceover talent's being recorded, and ADR and looping and anything to do with Hollywood. There's a lot more options out here for voice talent. So if they want to work a ton, this is where they'll come.
You know, that's kind of interesting, because during the show, I'd like to get into that subject with you, because between, you know, ISDN lines and now IP audio over the internet, it's certainly not a requirement that a VO talent be in the Hollywood area. And yet, even though we have the ability to do voiceover work from, you know, almost anywhere in the world, certainly any good sized city in the world with good ISDN or internet connections, still people tend to gravitate toward these work centers where content, where movies, where animation, as you said, where television is made. Let's go ahead and explore that right now before we get into some of the technicalities of designing and building a voiceover studio. Why do people gravitate anyway toward places where they actually may or may not have to be to get the work?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Well, you know, there's a couple different kinds of talent out there. There's a couple different tiers. You know, there's the top tier, and some of them can live anywhere. Most of them choose to live here, but I do have some top tier clients who are doing promo, trailer stuff that's national or even international, that do live outside of this market, but still the vast majority seem to propagate here. I don't know. It's a nice place to live. But also, you know, they want to have, it's a good question. If you could live anywhere, where would you live? And so, you know, because of that, there are clients of mine that are in Florida, you know, New York, and then sometimes, you know, in the Midwest and just somewhere in a nice big chunk of land in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, it really depends on what somebody wants, but anybody can do voiceover work from anywhere. As long as you've got a broadband internet connection, if you have the wherewithal and the creativity, you can do voice acting from anywhere.
Hey, Chris and Chris, you guys, please feel welcome to jump in here with a question. I got a whole list of questions in my head here that I want to ask about. I got a question for Chris Tobin and Chris Tarr before we get into George giving us his examples of voiceover studios that he has engineered, set up, built for various talent, probably some big name talent that we've all heard of. Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, what kind of home or voiceover studios have you guys been involved in building? Do you have, morning show talent or some kind of talent that needs to do something from home? A few years ago, I visited Harpo Studios in Chicago, where Oprah Winfrey, does her show. And the engineers there told me, well, Oprah has also a small VO studio at her Chicago apartment, right, at her condo. Sometimes they might need her to say a sentence or add something that they forgot to have her say during the day when she was at the studios. So, they would ask her to, open the closet, turn on the Telos Zephyr Extreme. They would dial into her and here, please read this copy. And, she'd go ahead and get that done. That's a kind of an interesting example. I mean, obviously Oprah didn't, sit down and record hours of voiceover there. She had a professional studio at Harpo Studios to do that. But for emergencies, there was that little room to get that done. Chris Tobin, let's go to you first. What kind of, at home or off-site studios have you been involved with?
Oh, the off-site studios have been real simple ones. So for a couple of our sports anchors to do their sports casts from home on the weekends, we did simple little foam acoustic foam partitions in a closet. A couple of the guys we just chose, let them use their clothing. Depending on the microphone we picked, it worked pretty well. And the microphones we've used have been pretty much dynamic mics, SM7s, a couple of RE20s, RE27s. Some of the talent preferred one or the other. We found the SM7s to be the most pleasing, smooth, predictable audio in each case. And then a couple of places we actually installed a whisper box. It's actually a full-blown soundproof, acoustically. The small ones, a couple locations that we did it at, it was necessary because they're home. The house was just not right. So we did it in the garage. It worked out really well. It's just, you gotta get creative and no one solution meets everybody's need. And I'm sure George knows that and others. So I would say in many cases, in a quick pinch, we've done the closet routine and it's worked really well. We've actually had one person, the closet was so dead, we actually had to put a little echo on, wet the audio a bit. we couldn't figure out why it sounded so strange. And we realized, it's really dead in there. But it worked out well. It complemented the, in this case, it was a woman's voice, which was very asymmetrical. So it had an interesting way of sounding when it was so quiet. It was good.
Chris Tarr, how about you? You got any offsite studios for folks maybe at their home or at a separate office or something?
Well, I've got a studio in my basement for the voiceover work I do.
Is
a little, it's probably a little fancier than what I would normally do. It's got, that's what I was talking about, the A50 console and a Shure SM5, Symmetrix voice processor. But generally, I've got one or two remote studios for talent. And really all that is, it's really nothing fancy. We use Comrex access boxes, and it's typically just like an RE20 into a Symmetrix voice processor into the Comrex access. And fortunately, I've run into cases with their houses where they have a little study or something like that, that most people have carpeted floors, things like that. So the rooms are pretty quiet. So I really haven't had to go through too much extreme to get somebody on the air. But you want to make sure that whatever you buy, first of all, especially matches the stuff you have in your studios. So if you're using Symmetrix 520EDs and SMR RE20s, make sure to get that for your talent who's going to be off-site so that you can at least get it pretty close. Obviously, the codecs and things can sometimes add a little bit of change to them, but you want to get them as clear as possible, as close as possible what you're running in the studio.
The advice from Chris Tobin and Chris Tarr sure seems like what any broadcast engineer would say. And so Let's bring in George now. George, my first question is, are we doing anything wrong? What would you do different than what we're doing?
Well, you know, you guys are still all in the context of radio broadcast. And the rest of the voiceover industry, or the voiceover industry, voice acting industry, is a pretty different world when it comes to sound, what the expectations for sound reproduction are. For it's really all about natural sound reproduction. If you're any more than 3 inches, if you're 3 inches or closer to a mic, you're probably not doing voiceover work. We tend to be, and I say we, I'm not a voice actor. I guess it's the royal we. You tend to work the mic further away, usually about six. We'll do the hang 10 thing to get about a 6 to 8 inch gauge away from the mic. And most of the time, we're using condenser microphones. We're not using WR20s or SM7s. Reason being that I find that we have to use condenser mics mostly is that a lot of voice talent do not have a very powerful voice, and especially some of the women and the book narrators, things like that. And if we need to get enough gain out of a SM7 or an RE20, we have to run the preamp wide open, sometimes higher than 60 decibels, and we end up with a noise floor that we consider unacceptable. The noise floor gets above minus 55 dB. It's not going to work for most voice work.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, yeah. So when you say natural, you know, there's most everybody in radio has a radio delivery. Now, whether it's the old, you know, the I'm ready radio, hopefully we're away from that. But still, plenty of folks work the mic. And so, George, you saying that in the voiceover business, that working the mic is not something that's done. You said they're typically, you know, hang 10 away from the mic. And so you're picking up a very natural sound and not an affected sound.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, as soon as I hear proximity effect, I immediately have someone back off the mic. Unless they come from radio, mm-hmm. or they have engineering background and they really do know how to work a mic. The vast majority of my clients are voice actors. They're SAG or AFTRA. They are actors. They're screen actors. And they're not used to even seeing a microphone. It's usually on a boom pole over their head. So, this is a whole new thing for them to have to be in a confined space with a microphone, not have the mic feel like it's, you know, obtrusive to them, but still be able to get it in the sweet spot. And I spend a lot of time, especially on all the consulting I do over the phone, which I'd say the majority of my work is done via Skype and stuff, is spent on positioning the mic and getting the room acoustics right. And we really like it dead in voiceover. It's a dead, almost anechoic room is what most voice engineers, voiceover engineers, producers are going to like to have, because they want to have complete control over the production and how it's going to sound in the mix and all of that. So we just give them clean, unadulterated, natural, no proximity effect or minimal proximity effect sound, and that's our goal. And it can be a real challenge depending on the situation that some of these clients are in with some pretty noisy spaces, especially here in Los Angeles.
Why don't you walk us through some examples of acoustics? By the way, I do want to get back to mic selection and preamp selection. I think that's real important and certainly something that a lot of broadcast engineers can relate to. I have my own client, a voiceover talent on the East Coast, for whom I've built a couple of rooms, and I have some of these same problems with getting the room noise down in this part of the country. Well, he's in Charleston, South Carolina, where homes tend to be all wood. There's no brick. And they're also on stilts above the ground, you know, for hurricanes and for, you know, the low-level flooding. So the houses tend to be very, very noisy. And so he's trying to do voiceover work in his house. So, man, we've gone to all kinds of lengths with heavy cloth and getting into a small space and then using, RLX or, you know, sound effect, you know, the sound deadening materials or absorption materials. And still it's tough to get. I mean, if a truck goes by outside, got to do that take all over again. Yeah. Where would a person start in taking an average space and making it as dead as possible, as quiet as possible.
Well, yeah, there's dead and there's quiet. And those two things are different and they require different solutions. And people, one of the biggest misnomers is calling Oralex soundproofing foam. Those two words should never, soundproof foam, never go together.
Right.
Because foam materials are not dense at all. And that, so they have an ability to absorb sound and keep it from bouncing around. Whereas, you know, when it comes to isolation, that's where we need to start talking about getting out the hammer and nails and maybe get a contractor. So it really depends on the severity of the issue. You know, and a lot of it actually, when somebody works with me, I'll first ask them, are you being directed or are you self-directed? And that basically means, you know, are you getting to work whenever the heck you want? Or do you have to work on demand? Are you scheduling, are your sessions scheduled? Are you on a phone schedule? Or if you have ISDN, obviously you're going to be working on a schedule. That's a big part of it, because if you can work any time, day or night, well, there's a lot of people doing book narration, you know, long form narration. They get up at, you know, they work from like 1 to 4 in the morning, 1 to 5 in the morning to get that quietest part of the day.
That's the quiet part of the day. It sure is.
Yeah. But I mean, whatever you got to do, you know, look, the book narration stuff, I think, is probably the most demanding in that it's long periods of time and you need a lot of uninterrupted time, very clean, very low noise. You know, when you listen to an audiobook, there's almost never any background music. So you're very exposed. Whereas doing stuff for radio and affiliates and commercials, there's almost always background music. So that masks, you know, some of the noise floor problems. So it really depends on what the kind of work you're doing. But we deal with the soundproofing first. And if budget allows, we solve that problem with double wall, double ceiling, sometimes even double doors, airtight rooms, air conditioning systems that have been properly designed so that they don't let any noise in or you can't hear the blower motors, clean power. You know, that's, you know, you're getting into, once we start talking in that language, we're talking about 30, 40 grand.
But,
you know, whisper rooms are a really good Band-Aid, and a lot of clients of mine have these, and they sound pretty bad. Out of the box, so we have to do a lot of acoustical treatment using additional materials to get them up to snuff.
Tell me about that. Not to point any fingers at the people who make whisper rooms, but you know, they make them for general purposes, and you have a very specific purpose in mind. So this whisper room, this is kind of like a closet that sits out in a room somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's basically a heavy box made out of 3/4 inch MDF wood. It's like a wardrobe, you know, and you walk in, you shut the door, and it knocks down the ambient noise from the outside by about 25 to 40 dB, depending on your frequency range that you're working in. And, you know, it takes that last bit of noise out of the room. If you got a pretty quiet house, you know, but you got computers, you got a fish tank, you got air conditioning, you jump in the whisper room and it takes out that last, you know, 20 to 40% of the background noise you really couldn't deal with otherwise. And at least it's portable. So it's not portable in that you can take it down and move it in your car, obviously. But these things weigh about 1,000 pounds start out. But you can move them to another place. If you're renting, they can be, you know, moved easily. And they have a resale value. Put them up on Craigslist and you can sell your used whisper room. I've helped quite a few people sell off their booths when they've kind of graduated to a custom-built space. But yeah, they were designed for all sorts of stuff, for practicing, for isolation, for practice rooms, for recording guitars and all sorts of stuff. So when it comes to voiceover, they give you a few sheets of RLX in there, but it takes a lot more thick, dense insulation. I usually will recommend something made out of Roxul or a fiberglass dense material like Owens Corning 703. That kind of material can much better deal with the full vocal range down into the low end, because those boxes and any small space, a closet, anything, will just resonate. It's got all this bass reflex and it just resonates and rings, and we have to get rid of that. And we do it with acoustics first, and then I'll tweak an EQ curve for them in their software with a graphic EQ or parametric to flatten it out even further.
So back to the acoustic treatment, you're treating the interior of the room to stop any further echo or ringing or resonation, right?
Exactly. It's all about treating the interior. So it's like we'll build a booth, and it's funny. We build out the walls. We fill it all with insulation. Then before the drywall goes up, I'll go in and go, it sounds great, doesn't it? It's totally dead. It's beautiful. Then we fill in all that space with drywall, and then it sounds terrible again. Yeah. Then I got to come back in and then put more absorbing material on the drywall on the inside of the room. So we've got the isolation properties of the dense drywall with an air gap between the two walls. Then we have the acoustical absorbing material on the inside to keep the echo from bouncing around and keep it from resonating. And so all those things work together.
Wow. So, okay, the next thing, you mentioned that after you get the room finished, you still have to go in and create an EQ curve. And this is something that you said in recording software that a talent might go and apply to everything he or she records. What kind of things do you do to come up with that EQ curve? Is this totally by experience and listening? Or are you doing anything with white noise and seeing, where the room changes, or any acoustic analysis?
That's a good question. I've played around with the idea of using acoustical analysis. And if in the luxury of where I actually get to be in someone's studio physically and bring along toys like that, I can do that. But, I think at this point, it really is experience. Working with so many different home studios, I've heard almost every scenario. And I really trust my ear. I listen closely. I do actually trust my headphones more than anything, because I unfortunately, ironically, don't have a great sounding home studio. I pretty much just have an office here. But I do trust my Beyerdynamic DT770 Pro headphones a lot. I've been using the same model of headphones for over 10 years. And, that's really important to me, a consistent, objective frame of reference, for the sound. And then, if the room sounds good, it doesn't take a lot. Does not take much EQ tweaking at all. I usually will roll off the bottom end. Like I said, that natural sound, we don't want it to be too muddy and boomy. It needs to be very clear and intelligible. So I'll almost always notch out everything below 75, 70 hertz, depending on the voice for women, 80 or 90. If the room is extra boomy and extra muddy sounding, I might even roll off as high as 120 hertz to deal with that. And then if there's one frequency that just seems to ring, and the smaller the closet, the higher the frequency. So if it's a small closet or booth, it could be 200-300 hertz. I'll notch that out of there. And then, maybe a little sizzle at the top end, maybe some air, like a boost at 20K, just to get a little extra sizzle and brightening. But
that high, huh?
De-essing.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, the mind really lights up here with all kinds of questions. De-essing is a pretty interesting technology. I'm sure every company that makes a de-esser or puts one in their mic preamp has a different philosophy on how to detect too much energy in the S range and what to do about it. So it's naturally taken out. Is de-essing something that's important for every VO talent or just certain VO talents?
It's just certain VO talent. I think it's a matter of if they're using the wrong kind of mic for their voice. It's amazing how much we can do by proper mic technique and mic positioning. Just getting the mic, sometimes just twisting it a little off axis, there goes your S. Sometimes it's just a slight change of position and there goes the S. But for more extreme cases, I tend to just not... I'm not a real uber geek with the plugins, and it's probably because I'm helping hundreds of other people figure this stuff out. So I really stick with the most basic elements. I work mostly in the Mac environment. So I will use a lot of the Apple Audio Units plugins that every single Mac comes with. So when I do something, they can replicate it on their end very easily. Uh-huh. And so I will often just use a graphic or a parametric, find whatever that frequency is that sticks out the most with the S and notch it out by 6 dB or so, as opposed to using an actual de-esser plugin.
Okay.
It depends on how severe the problem is. And of course, that's also I'm using the EQ along with the compressor, and I usually will put the EQ before compression. And it seems to work for most people, except the most extreme cases.
Yeah, actually, that's a pretty interesting conversation there. Should EQ go before compression in a mic processor setup or after? And I've seen it done both ways, and I guess my own self, I liked it after for most applications, because if it was, well, of course, in radio, a lot of times, you know, a jock, a talent will want that bottom end boosted up. So we'll give a nice bump there at 60 or 70 or 75 hertz or so, depending on the bottom end range of that talent. And if that bump comes before the compressor, well, then the compressor is acting on the bump and not right. on the rest of the audio. So you can get some you know, pumping going on there. But right. in your world of trying to get very natural audio, it could be what you really want that EQ to do is to correct any aberrations, not create any affectations. Right.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. You know, I'm the only place I will ever really boost at anything is maybe at the very, very top end. Only slightly boost in the bottom range occasionally if they're just, you know, it just needs a little something. But most of what I'm doing is cutting and notching. And so I like to do that before compression. And then if I really do want to lay it on and create something that has, you know, a larger than life sound, something that needs to be ready for air, pre-produced or pre-sweetened, I like to call it, then maybe you can throw up another EQ after the compressor for that need. I think that seems to work pretty well that way for me.
So you're using a separate EQ. So you might have EQ before a compressor and EQ after a compressor. Would you ever use multi-band compression, or is this always a wideband compression for a VO talent?
Yeah. I'm a wimp when it comes to the multi-band compressor. I know it's incredibly powerful, and it can be used to, you know, amazing results. Isn't that what Orbind uses?
Oh, well, the first multiband for broadcast was developed by Mike Duro, and he made Duro. The DAP, the discriminant audio processor. And then, but since that time, most broadcast audio processors have been multiband, but we're trying to achieve something a little bit different in broadcast yeah. than we are in VO service. So hence my question, most mic processors don't have multiband processing. So I just wondered if that wasn't the least bit important. I mean, the company I work for, Axia, Omnia, and Telos, we have mic processing in the Axia consoles developed by Omnia, and yeah. and it's not multiband. It's just wideband processing because that seems to be appropriate for voice purposes. Yeah. But I was wondering if any talent said, "Hey, I really like the sound of this or that multiband kind of a processor."
See, I
go ahead. Sorry, Chris.
Oh, it's funny. I had that conversation with production people, and even outside of radio. And usually, the talents, especially if they've been on radio, the talents first, I think the first tweak they try to do is A, turn up the bass, and then the second tweak they do is B, they try to compress the heck out of their voice. And you know, it all depends on the application and in broadcast purposes, especially when people are doing voiceover work for broadcast. I really think it's important to subscribe to the less is more when it comes to EQing and that sort of thing. And you know, I really think that you want to have as clean and as open a product as you can, because the radio station yeah. is going to use their $20,000 squash box to flatten it all out. So if you do that ahead of time and you try to take that already really tightly processed voice product and push it through the processors, they don't do a very good job of making the audio sound better. And, you know, then it sounds really, you know, it sounds really muffled. Plus, when you're using multiband compression and limiting, if you turn up the bass on your voice, all you're going to get is mud on the other end. The bass is going to be so powerful compared to the rest of your voice. So, yeah. I would like to see radio guys, radio engineers, follow more of what we've been talking about here with being very sensitive to a nice, clean mic technique, nice, clean microphones, kind of less is more with processing. And I really think that the commercials that jump out at you on radio and TV are the ones that use that technique.
Yeah, it's the natural read. The thing that's so hot right now and that's hiring the people for commercial and promo, or especially commercial work, is sort of like that non-announcer read. They just sort of talk like this. You know, that's what's hot right yeah. now. And, yep. It's a different way. You need to capture it differently. But I'm a very big less is more KISS type of, I have that philosophy because, you know, it'd be different if I was a producer, or it'd be different if I worked in a studio as an engineer and I was getting the product and now I got to, like, you know, have total say over what the final mix was going to be. That's where that needs to be happening. But that's not the world that I get to play in. I'm playing at the front end, right at the microphone, right with all the talent. And I just need to make sure that what's going to get to the producer at the other end is something that they're really going to like working with, and therefore will want to keep hiring that talent over and over again.
And it sounds like having a clean, unaffected sound is what a producer would want, because then he's got this nice, predictable slate to work with. He's got this thing that he doesn't have to go fix stuff first. The basics are there, and the producer can then go add whatever he wants to, if it's reverb or echo or sweeten it up or compress the heck out of it, whatever he needs. Is that the philosophy of a good VO talent, to provide something that's clean and unaffected?
Oh yeah, definitely. That's definitely the philosophy that I use, and that's what most of the clients like to have. It's in a few cases where I have a client who does work for a small market station or commercial work for a low budget, or, you know, local commercials or webcasts, or where they expect the talent to provide something that's already, it's basically ready for air. You know, sometimes a voice talent will send off their file. Then they'll watch the final product on YouTube or online or something, and they'll go, it just sounds flat and terrible, because all they did was take this WAV file or MP3 that was sent to them, dropped it into Final Cut, and, you know, put the music in there, and that was it. And a lot of times now, with the budgets getting shrinking, and, you know, the expectations increasing for product, you know, it's like the engineers are being taken out of the equation. I can't believe how many post houses and trailer houses have a Final Cut editing bay or Avid editing bay with a Zephyr, and the talent is going right into that Final Cut track. And the editor in there very, very rarely has any audio processing experience. So unless the talent is sending them something that already sounds punched up, it's not going to be a good mix. So it's all over the board. It's all over the board.
It's interesting. You bring up something that actually one of my production directors and I were going over a couple of weeks ago, and it happened to be a major network, TV network, and their promo spots that they sent to us put on the air. And you could tell it was the same voice, but over the course of a few months, how, you know, it started out with really decent processing, and then it could, you know, there were some that were just awful, and there was absolutely no consistency. You'd have some stuff that was absolutely not processed at all, and some of it that was very sweet. And it kind of leads me back again, you know, with the production houses. You know, you can always add things, but you can't ever take them away when it comes to things like EQ and processing and stuff. So, yeah. You know, I you're right. I mean, you know, with your step, it needs to be as natural as possible, because then the production people can then take it, you know, at the spot houses or whatever, can take it and add or subtract what they want. But even they kind of have to have some responsibility in making sure that what they send out is clean after that. You know, you want to punch it up and make it sizzle a little bit, that's fine. But again, you know, a lot of us spend a lot of money on audio processing expecting stuff that isn't, you know, that has a dynamic range to work with to begin
sure.
with. So, you know,
that's what
the stuff that's, you know.
Yeah, I tell clients all the time, like, don't listen to the radio, then go home and then expect to create that sound. If you're basing the results of what you're recording in your home booth on what you heard in the car on the way home, you're completely screwing up your frame of reference, because, like you said, I tell them, I was like, that's some really heavy duty, you know, processing that happens before it hits the radio or the air. And don't go by that. If you want to go by something, go by example, then, you know, at least TV is a little less processed. But go onto a website like voicebank.net, where there's thousands and thousands of hours of people's auditions and demo materials to listen to.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor right now. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with George Whittam about building voiceover studios. And I'm learning a lot here. Sounds like George's philosophy, you know, get the basics right. And that you got to get that right, or else it's not going to be right. And George, I hope you can give us some war stories too about some of your clients. If you don't name names, that's okay. But I'd like to hear some interesting things about what you've seen and experienced in the field.
Absolutely.
Hey, our sponsor is my employer. Thank you so much, Axia Audio, for sponsoring this little show and helping get the word out to engineers all over the world about what is going on in broadcast engineering. Axia Audio. These are the guys who helped to invent the live wire real-time audio protocol for getting audio over IP immediately. Now, this is, by the way, live wire, this technology, this is not for getting audio long distances, like over the phone company, over the internet. Live wire is what you need to run a studio or a cluster of studios with absolutely live, unbuffered and also uncompressed, that is not bit compressed, but linear audio over a standard Ethernet IP network. This makes it very easy to connect audio consoles with all kinds of different pieces of equipment in the studio and in the rack room. And hey, Chris Tobin, are you with us right here?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
All right. Chris, you know, your former employer was CBS, and you were involved in building out or in putting some new studios at Wins. Take just a minute here and tell us about how LiveWire helped you to get that done in New York City in an efficient manner.
Well, we had four studios that needed to be redone. The project entailed not going offline, so we had to build in place, which you can imagine is not easy at a 24-hour news radio station here in New York City. So LiveWire, Axia, we looked at it and realize that it is, I'll use the phrase plug and play. You do a little programming and you know, beforehand before you start plugging stuff in. And we planned it out. We did one studio, one control room at a time, built it out, you know, stripped it out completely, brand new countertops, furniture, and then dropped in the consoles. All Cat 5 wiring, very traditional stuff, nothing special. Point to point, did everything within a couple of months. Each studio took no more than, I think, a week and a half to get done. Remember, this is a live, in-place job. This is not something where I can walk in, brand new facility. You know, the rooms are empty, nobody to bother you. If you had that case, we did build one of the studios in less than, I think, a day as a quick ad hoc because we had an emergency come up. But over a course of a couple of months, we built out four studios online, never went off the air once, never had a hiccup. And during that time, we had one, two, six live broadcasts, four breaking news stories, one of them an airplane flying into a building, a Yankees player that died, and then a plane and a couple other incidences. So it was very busy newsroom while we were building. And the best part about it, I will say, the IP technology and the fact that you can program and get the audio you need anywhere on that LAN network. As Kirk pointed out, it's real-time, uncompressed, and wherever you can drop the Cat 6 cable, you have your audio sources and destinations. And our newsroom required a lot of, if you will, crazy mix minus returns, four wire audio paths to and from locations offsite, and the live wire capabilities using the various nodes just made it real easy. I mean, I literally dropped in cables in places last minute. A producer position was made ad hoc in the middle of the newsroom, one Cat 5 cable, pair of headphones, microphone, and a node, and off we were. I mean, literally in seconds in many cases. So, understand, think out of the box. I will say that because I've had many friends come by and see the facility we put together and were somewhat amazed at how complex the workflow was and that the simplicity in which we did it with the live wire.
I've gone into so many Axia studios, including the one that you put together at Wins in New York. And most folks are amazed at where's all the wire? Well, this is a network. I mean, imagine if in your office situation, if you wanted your computer to talk to the internet, that was one wire, and another wire to go to this printer, and another wire to go to that printer, and another wire to go to the rest of the office LAN, or to this computer or that computer. And this is the whole beauty of being on a network. When you can get all the audio onto an Ethernet IP network, then you just need a CAT cable, and you've got access to everything. Every resource and every destination that is on the network, you've got access to. And this makes it so easy for an engineer to design, plan, wire, execute, and configure, and then operate studios, whether you're talking about a small situation like my little radio station in Cleveland, Mississippi, where we have one live wire studio, soon to be two, or whether you're talking about a huge outfit, well, like Wins, which was pretty big, but then you have places like over in Prague, Czech Republic, where you've got something like 50 studios of Axia live wire all connected together, and you have something like 4,000 sources and 4,000 destinations all on the network. Makes it very easy to add things, subtract things, and be flexible wherever you need a certain audio anywhere in the building, you got it. And of course, the sizes of places anywhere in between. Hey, there's the Element console at the Twit Network, and it's right now producing custom mix minuses for each of the participants in this show. I'm hearing everybody but me. George Whittam is hearing everybody but George. Chris Tobin and Chris Tarr are each hearing everybody but themselves. Mix Minus is automatic. So many cool advantages. Listen, I don't want to take up the rest of the show with Axia. So tell you what, why don't you go to the Axia website at axiaaudio.com. Plenty of white papers there, examples of how this technology works. There's a great document called Intro to Livewire Version 2, 2.0, 2.1 something. This document was written in part by Steve Church, the founder of Telos. And you're going to find that to be very interesting if you haven't read it already. About 80 pages long or so, and just tells all about the Livewire story and how things work and how it fits together. And yeah, if you need a little background in networking, it's got that in there. If you know all about networking, skip that and get right to the salient points of how Livewire works and what it can do for you. Also, please feel welcome to sign up for our catalog. If you haven't gotten that yet, it's the Now catalog from Telos, Omni, and Axia. Happy to send you one. And if you buy anything from Telos, Omni, or Axia, you're probably going to find that a catalog comes in the box too. All right. Thanks a lot to our sponsor, Axia Audio, for sponsoring this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. All right, back to George Whittam. George, you still with us?
I'm still here.
All right.
Just got to pick up the mic game.
So, man, just a thousand questions and 15, 20 minutes left in our time together here. So many engineers want to know about mic selection. You know, there are so many brands and models out there. I mean, I used to use this fabulous microphone. I have it right over here from Violet. This is a condenser mic, and I just love this thing. But I also have gotten this Heil microphone from Bob Heil. It's a dynamic microphone, and a lot of them are used at the Twit Network. I love the way it sounds, too. They sound different. I like them both. This one is probably more affected. I'm not sure it's as natural, but I like the way it sounds, whereas the Violet condenser mic, very natural, but maybe you had to know how to work it just right to get it to sound good. Tell me how you and a VO talent would go about selecting a mic or maybe a couple of mics to sound best for that talent.
Yeah, well, the dynamic mics really do have an advantage in that they are, because of their design and because of their low sensitivity, and they sound pretty nice when you work them up close. They are really forgiving. You can deal with a room with not so great acoustics and a little bit more background noise. And whereas condenser mics are a lot more persnickety. They hear a lot more. And somebody I've heard say a few times, a Neumann U87 can hear a mouse fart across the room.
Oh, no kid. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's the blessing and the curse of these mics. But, you know, if the budget is part of the concern, there's so many options under $300 now. It's mind boggling. That sound surprisingly good. The AT2035 is a great budget mic. The V89, I think it is real smooth and it's got pretty low noise. I could just drop mics all night. If for some people that want the absolute most brain dead simple home studio setup, and I set up these mostly for like screen actors that have no interest whatsoever in knowing what's going on with their equipment. Some of the USB mics now, even they're actually getting to the point where I can actually recommend them. The PG42 USB by Shure, that's a surprisingly decent sounding USB mic. It's really, really quite nice. It's got a pretty low noise floor for a USB mic. And then the MXL 009-2496 USB mic. That's sort of like, I'd say, a top of the line USB mic, and that's still like $400. But yeah, when people are just getting started, I don't waste a lot of time and energy in budgeting for a microphone. And I don't recommend beginners going out and trying a lot of mics because they'll get completely overwhelmed. They're not going to hear what it is from one mic to the next that makes the difference. Mm. But when it comes to more seasoned talent that have been at it for a while, it's so funny. Here in LA, the 800-pound gorilla microphone is the Sennheiser 416, the shotgun microphone. The first time I saw one in a voiceover booth, I just was scratching my head. Because I did production sound mixing too. I was used to having one of these on the end of a boom pole. Yep. And I was like, what on earth? Why is this? What is this doing here? Well, it just ended up in the hands of a prominent voice talent that thought it was the only way he was going to, it was the only way they're going to get clean audio of him sitting in a studio next to a console. So it's the voice actor who did The Love Boat. All the VO for The Love Boat. He's one of the most notorious
Ernie voice Anderson. Talent.
Ernie Anderson. Thank you. Yeah. His name slips out of my... Ernie, they put one up in front of Ernie because Ernie didn't want to be in the booth where people could talk about him behind his back. So he wanted to sit in the control room right next to the board. And the only mic they could find that could tolerate that kind of a ambient noise and reject it was a shotgun, I think a 415. It just stuck. You know, when one prominent voice talent uses it, more people start using it, and all of a sudden it becomes one of the go-to mics.
Sure.
But I don't think it works for everybody. It's certainly not that great for most female voices because it's got a lot of presence peak and a lot of presence boost, so it tends to get sibilant really quick. Of course, being a super cardioid, it's got a very small window that you have to be in. You have to almost have your head in a vise. Google George Del Hoyo, D-E-L-H-O-Y-O, and try to find some, or maybe go to YouTube and Google his name. Find a video clip of George. He's on a 416 and he's talking and his hands are going mile a minute. He's so physical, but his head is perfectly locked in front of that 416.
That's quite a technique.
It's a totally different world, you know. But you know, Neumanns are everywhere. TLM-103 is one of the love hate mics. Some people just think it's fantastic. Some people can't stand it. I have a few clients with U87s, but not too many because, like I said, to get a $3,000 mic like that to sound good and not pick up stuff you don't want takes a really great sounding, very quiet room. So not too many people are using that. I like talking about some of the smaller companies that don't have the notoriety of Neumann, like Mojave Audio, which is right here in the LA area. They make a beautiful one called the MA201 FET. And it's under $1,000. I think it's in the $800 range. And there's some amazingly super high fidelity, fantastic sounding, very quiet, amazing give a Neumann run for the money mics now in the sub $800 range. Another one called Charter Oak, another company called Charter Oak, who's in New England. Incredible microphone. I mean, if you go to NAM or AES or even NAB, but not so much NAB, more NAM or AES, it'll blows your mind how many new mics come out every year. It's just making it all that harder now to pick a microphone. But I like to make sure the room is dialed in. If the room's dialed in acoustically, if the talent has good technique, I can, okay, for an example, Don LaFontaine, I worked for him. I was his home studio tech for a while. His go-to mic at the time, at the time of his passing, was still the Manly cardioid, or reference cardioid. It's about a $2,800 tube mic. He occasionally would get another mic in there that somebody would send him, you know, hoping that Don would endorse their product or give it the seal of approval. He had a Browner in there. He had SE2200 mics from a couple hundred to a couple $1,000s. And he would switch them out from time to time, just based on whatever mic was sent to him. Did any engineer ever once complain that Don changed mics or say, What mic is that, Don? You're not sounding quite as great. No way. As Don told me one time, he said, I could talk into a tin can as long as they could hear me. They're happy. But
Now, what about Don himself? Would Don notice a difference from one mic to the next, or would he definitely hear one and not like it?
Yeah, well, Don had some engineering background. He actually did audio engineering, in the 60s, I think. So he definitely had an ear for that stuff, and he liked equipment. He really liked gear. He was into it. And he definitely could hear differences, but he always went back to that Manly mic. It's got a really aggressive sound, and Don's voice was an interesting mixture of low rumble and just, but also it had a presence in the mid range that could just cut through any mix.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he was so, other than just being a consummate professional and a one take wonder and all that, you know, there's a lot of reasons why people liked working with him, but his voice quality was just amazing. One of a kind. So he could make almost any mic sound good.
I think we got to at least spend a few minutes on the subject of mic preamps. For a couple of clients that I've had, I've gone through a number of preamps and, you know, been a little happy, a little disappointed. What do you look for in what a mic preamp can do? And I guess for me, the first thing is it's got to be very low noise, because that noise will just get sucked up in processing and sound bad. What do you look for?
That's definitely the very first criteria is low noise. I really recommend most of my clients do all their processing, if any at all, and we talked about that earlier, doing it in the box in their software. So the requirements to have a lot of bells and whistles, channel strips, that kind of stuff is less and less. However, there's a few preamps that just seem to persist. One of them is the Avalon 737 preamp. It's the tube preamp. It's very, very clean for a tube preamp, but I still kind of lean away from tubes when I'm choosing the preamp, because that means something else for somebody to have to, that means more maintenance, that means replacing tubes, it means a lot more heat, you know, things that I just don't like, especially if the preamp's going to end up inside someone's booth. So I tend to lean towards solid state, and at the low end of the spectrum, well, the lowest end of the spectrum, if you want a channel strip, the DBX 286A, which some of you guys in radio probably have used, because it's it's a little bit like a 528E with not quite as many knobs, but it's a full feature unit with a really surprisingly good downward expander gate. That one I've set up for quite a few people when they have to go straight to ISDN and they need a little bit of gating in the signal to clean up the bottom end, to clean up the noise floor. Going up from there, like the Grace M101, I think for $500, that one's pretty much impossible to beat for just ultra clean, you know, wire with gain preamp. And then it came out with a M103, which is that preamp in a channel strip form with a compressor and a compressor and EQ. I don't think there's a gate on that. And I've been swapping out Avalon 737s for those, where I want to just try to clean up the signal, just get a little bit lower noise floor. And I find that those things sound phenomenal. And if you got the wallet, man, the Focusrite Red 7 or the Red 1, I think the Red 1, no, the Red 7, I think is the channel strip, is, gosh, incredible sounding. But, you know, $4,000+. So. Yeah.
Wow. I think we could go on and on. I'll tell you what, you mentioned a little bit about Don LaFontaine. Maybe there's another story or two that you could tell us about. You know, what did you learn, you know, working with a talent? What was maybe a really teachable moment in terms of, oh man, I picked the wrong mic for that guy, or I should have done we came back later and had to do more insulation, or man, this particular talent was really hard to find the right EQ for. What happy accidents or learning moments can you tell us about?
Oh, yeah. Well, with Don, that was an interesting situation, because I mean, first of all, the first time I met him, I didn't have the first clue who he was. Not a clue. The name didn't ring a bell, anything. And the guy that referred me to him, Steve Nafshin, is a client and a friend of mine here in LA, he said, George, you'll know. You'll know who he is. Trust me. I said, okay. And I went to his amazing home in near somewhere in Las Feliz, and went in, still didn't really know who he was. Went down to his studio down in the basement that was already there because he had a studio with ISDN long before I got to know him in 2006 is when I met him. And still didn't know who he was. He went into the booth. He said, I got to go run to the booth and do this thing for Fox. He goes in there and does a spot for The Simpsons or something. And I just slapped my head and just gasped. I said, oh my gosh, I'm working with the icon of voiceover. You know, people call him the voice of God. It blew my mind. But, you know, that said, he had 10-year-old gear. Everything in there was like 10 years old. When I got there, he was running his Manly straight into a Mackie 24x8 console because the preamp, well, there was no preamp. It was, I mean, he was running the preamp and the Mackie, but it blew my mind. And there was like a buzz on the signal. And that was really the impetus for me coming in anyways, because Steve was telling me, the guy referred me, was saying, Don's got a buzz on his signal and we got to get rid of this. And people have been kind of tolerating it because it's Don, but we got to fix this, you know? So when I went in there, there was a lot of problems. And the biggest problem we had of all at Don's place was his studio, whoever designed it, thought it was a good idea to put every piece of technology for his entire home all in that room. And he had Crestron, you know, with multi-room entertainment. He had the lighting system in the entire house was all computer-controlled electronic dimming. All the dimmers were in a panel directly behind the mixing console position. Oh. I mean, the RFI or maybe even magnetic interference, maybe is more what it was atrocious. It was so bad. I mean, because he had a good preamp, we put a good preamp in there in the booth, and we put it at the mic in the booth. So we were pushing the high, you know, the best signal possible back over. And then we yanked out that Mackie, put a little Allen and Heath mix wizard in there. And, but man, even with all that, and I got like a top of the line, you know, noise filtering unit, it didn't matter. No matter what we did, everything else in that studio had some kind of a buzz on it. When in the evening, when all the lights started coming on, it was just atrocious. So, yeah, it was just frustrating, and it was so far along that I would have had to tear everything out. It would have been a major, major remodel. If I knew then what I know now about Faraday cages, I probably would have made a copper mesh screen over the whole thing and then grounded it and did all that, but. You know, I learned some of that stuff as I went along, but yeah, sometimes the top tier talent, you know, get bad advice and get bad engineering and bad engineers working for them. They see, I guess these guys, they see dollar signs and, you know, they go in there, sell them a lot of impressive stuff, but then where the rubber meets the road, they make some really bad mistakes. And that's kind of tend to be what happened there. Otherwise, you know, a lot of most of the horror stories I ever deal with are just with technical problems that interrupt a client and keep them from earning a living. In voiceover, if you have an outage on an ISDN and you can't get to a studio quick enough or you can't work around it, you know, there's no real contracts anymore in VO. So a guy who's doing all of the NBC drama evening, you know, promo spots, next day it could be somebody else. And they've lost a $20, $30, $50, $80,000 gig because something went down. So the studios just have to be super simple, super reliable, wherever possible, backups in place. I like getting something like Source Connect to back up ISDN these days. And, you know, that seems to be the trend. It's just keeping things as reliable as possible. So I have as few of these hair-pulling phone calls that make my, you know, make my heart jump into my throat when I get them. You know what I mean?
I think Chris Tobin had a question. Chris?
Yeah, along the lines of keeping things simple and reliable so you don't lose revenue for yourself, what would you say for someone starting out in voice work, whether it's commercial, non-commercial, corporate video, corporate audio, that kind of stuff, if they're looking to do a home studio, roughly, you know, what would they expect to budget cost-wise? you know, just basic stuff to be able to do what they have to do.
Well, you know, if you get creative with some moving blankets and some pillows and curtains and kind of make a dead corner in your bedroom or your office, which you can do, you can go quite a long ways with a very small budget that way. You know, set yourself aside about $1,000. Get yourself like a, you know, a USB mic. If you're on a Mac, get Twisted Wave. I love Twisted Wave for recording and editing. It's just super simple and easy to learn, and it's fast and reliable. If you're on Windows, sorry, but if you're on Windows, Audacity. It's not bad considering it's free. It's pretty capable. I like SoundForge. In the Windows environment, I think that's the got the best combination of features and simplicity. And you know, get yourself a real sturdy microphone, a pop filter. Microphone stand. Microphone wise, you know, I love that PG-42. It's a hard one to flaw. And then budget the rest of that money on expertise. You know, if you've got $1,000 to spend, don't buy $1,000 mic. Buy, you know, $600 or $700 worth of gear and software, and put the rest of your budget into hiring somebody to make it sound amazing. Because you can spend hours, days, weeks, months, sometimes years, getting wrong advice or varied advice from the forums and all this stuff. And boy, I've had clients where they're like, "Oh my gosh, I wish I knew about you 2 years ago." And you know, I'll say, "How long have you had your setup like this?" And they're like, "Oh, about a year and a half." I'm like, "Are you getting a lot of work?" And they're like, "No, that's why I'm hiring you." And they're not getting advice from people, and they're not getting objective feedback on their audio, and so they're not realizing the reason why they're not getting calls. It's not their talent, it's their sound quality. So hire an expert. Make sure you have somebody there physically or at least virtually to make sure the room is tuned, your mic position's there, and you've learned how to use your software, because that is, I can't possibly emphasize enough how important that is.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So $1,000, that's good.
I'll tell you what sucks really now is that we're basically out of time. But I want to take enough time to ask George to... George, understand that you have a podcast of your own where you give this kind of advice and talk about studios and VOs. Where can people find you?
Oh, well, the webcast is called East West Audio Body Shop, and we were clearly influenced by Car Talk and also by Leo himself and his shows. But that's at ewabs.com, EWABS.com. Check that out. That's every Sunday live, just like us. We are now live at 6 o'clock Pacific. And my voiceover studio consulting website is vostudiotech.com. And there's a lot of info on there, facts, articles I've written, tutorial videos, you name it, anything you can imagine that would help you set up a home studio. So there's a my blog is on there under the resource. There's a blog post. I try to get a blog post up every week to 2 weeks. And sometimes when I get I'm on a bender, I might get two or three in one night. Sign up the mailing list and I'll keep you in the loop. Whenever something that pops up that I think is going to be a game changer or just a handy tip for voiceover, I'll put it in the newsletter or I'll put it up on the blog.
Very cool. Very cool. Hey, Chris Tarr, I'm sorry. Do we block you out or are you still there?
I'm still here. Just fascinating stuff that you're just talking about. I was just quietly, intently listening.
Yeah, trying to soak it all in. I hope we have George back again sometime, but since it may be some time before we do, I do feel welcome to check out George's website. Was it vostudiotech.com? V-O as in voiceover, vostudiotech.com. Did I get that right?
That's right. You got it. Thank you, guys. Good. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for being on the show. And hey, we have to do a little giveaway here. For the last quite a few weeks, we've been giving away one license of Omnia AXE. This is software that runs as a service in Windows. So hey, at least it's reliable. It runs in that service area, and it does audio processing and then audio encoding to make make streams for you that you can then send out to a Shoutcast server or to a Wowza server and get your audio on the web if that's what you need to do. Or if you just need some audio processing, you can just go in and out of your computer and get processed audio out using Omnia AX processing. This processing is appropriate for obviously web streaming, so it will give you the kind of audio that the encoder is looking for. Let's give one away to someone who retweeted the announcement that this show was starting about an hour ago. And I need George, I need a random number here between 1 and 22.
Oh, let's pick 7.
7. 7. Hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Is that between
6.
1 and... Yeah.
Yeah, that is. All right, congratulations to... let me see here. I think I know this person. Of course, I know half of our listeners. Let's see. Fastbreak 8000. That's the Twitter handle. Fastbreak 8000. I thought I saw... Is that, I think that is Vinny Lopez. Is that right? Yeah. Oh, Vinny awesome. Lopez. Hey, congratulations, Vinny. Thanks for watching and retweeting. Is Vinny a current or past SBE president?
He is.
Maybe past.
Past.
Past?
Yeah.
Just past? Okay. Vinny Lopez, Fastbreak 8000 on Twitter. Thanks for thanks for retweeting. Thanks to everybody who retweeted. I sure appreciate it. Can't give away one to everybody, but Vinny Lopez, you are the Omnia AXE winner. Hey, thanks also to AxiaAudio.com for sponsoring this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. I certainly appreciate them. And I'll tell you who else appreciates them. Every one of the folks who owns one of the 2,500-plus Axia consoles in service around the world using Ethernet IP audio. Really fantastic stuff. Works so well. I'm a user, and someday we'll bring Chris Tarr into the fold too. Chris, you going to be a user one day?
Oh, I hope so.
hey, when you do, Chris, just don't do it in the winter, but I'll come up there and help you out a little bit.
Cool. I'll have to, whatever, if we do it, it's going to be in nice weather. I'll make sure to plan for that.
And make sure there's plenty of beer cheese soup.
Absolutely.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. Hey, thanks, everybody, for being with us. George Windham, appreciate you being our guest. Folks can look at you at vostudiotech.com. Thanks again.
Thank you, man. I had a blast. It was an honor to be on the show.
And from Manhattan, the man who can't go anywhere right now because it's all locked down, Chris Tobin. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
You're welcome. And thank you, George. I learned a lot and it reinforced some of the thoughts and ways I've done stuff as well. Thank you again.
Oh, my pleasure.
And live from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, Chris Tarr. Thanks for being with us, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll look for you on a next show. Next show, Terry Bond will be our guest. And the next one after that, it's Bob Orban. Thank you for being with us. We appreciate you watching and telling your friends to watch also This Week in Radio Tech. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye, everybody.